All right. Carnivore Soldier coming at you from Austin, Texas. Today we've got another new stream coming up. This is a new playlist on my YouTube channel and a new podcast called The Carnivore Way. And we're going to be focusing on carnivore YouTubers. This carnivore YouTuber is from way down under. I believe he's from Brisbane, or Brisbane, as they call it. And his name is David Charles. He's known as DC Learning to Live. And he's got an incredible story to share with us about fighting cancer through carnivore. So let me bring him in and we'll let him introduce himself. Hey, David, how you doing?
Hey, Larry. I'm great. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate
Now, do you want me to call you David or DC?
David's fine, or DC. David?
Okay.
Yeah, either one's fine.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I gave him a little teaser. Why don't you just introduce yourself first, who you are? Did I say it right? Are you in Brisbane or Brisbane?
Yep, that's right.
Brisbane. Okay, yep. You're in Brisbane. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or introduce yourself. You just call it Brizzy for short.
Brizzy. I like it.
Yeah.
I'm all about the short.
Yeah. Yeah, the quicker the better. Okay, so my story started back in 2011 when I was living in Japan with my wife in a small town between the city of Sendai and the coast of Miyagi. Miyagi is the prefecture, like state in Japan. Mm-hmm. In March 11, we were hit by a 9-magnitude earthquake and then the tsunami afterwards. That was pretty brutal. You know, this was an earthquake that lasted 6.5 minutes almost. It was 6 minutes, 15, 16 seconds or so. It's like the longest 6 minutes of your life.
Wait, listen, I got to break in because I've been in a big earthquake, but nothing that big. I was in the Bay Area during the Loma Prieta earthquake, which was 5.6. And it lasted for 40 seconds, I think, or 36. And I got to tell you, that was the longest 36 seconds of my life, too, because... Yeah. And I can't imagine yours is thousands of times more strong than that.
Yeah. It was a shallow one as well.
So, yeah.
Which makes it more violent. Yeah. Like you said, like most earthquakes only last 15 to 40 odd seconds. They don't last that long. And they do a lot of damage, of course. But this one lasted over 6 minutes. You know, and it just kept rolling and rolling. It was crazy. And in the days following it, like even the aftershocks, some of the aftershocks were over 8 magnitude.
You know, and you guys were in shock, because I know I was in shock from the earthquake. Yeah. It's like PTSD. Yeah. You go through a shock period.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. You certainly do. Especially how long it lasted. It just kept going. You keep expecting it to stop. Because Japan has a lot of earthquakes. I was quite used to them. They would only last a few seconds, though. But this one just kept going and going. And then on average, for the first couple of weeks after that, every 5 minutes, there was another aftershock. And some, like I said, were over 8 magnitude themselves. It got to the point, a friend of mine was saying, we were talking about it, and he said, like, anything under 7 magnitude is not worth getting out of bed for. we started getting used to it. It was crazy.
That's incredible.
Yeah. And yeah, then we spent the next few months, we had a little bit of preparation because of previous earthquakes. So we had a little bit of food and water and stuff like that. But then all the food supplies and everything were cut off. So we were stuck for the next couple of months to riding around on bicycles, trying to find food and water. And then I was having some health issues, getting sick with colds and flus and things like that. I had a bit of abdominal pain, but it was through those times. It's not like I had a lot of time to go see a doctor and get this checked out. And then when things started settling down, and we did a bit of volunteer work, going out, cleaning up some of the tsunami areas and helping people in shelters, and then tried to rebuild our lives. And throughout all this, I had family in Australia telling me, you have to come back to Australia and, you know, forget about that stuff. And I was adamant I was going to stay in Japan because that's where my whole life was.
You know, let me stop you here. What was your life in Japan at that time? You and your wife, what were you doing for a living before the earthquake?
Yeah, I was a strength and conditioning coach. I also taught English to kids and up to university level on as a side job, but I had my own strength and conditioning business as well. My wife is a seamstress. She worked for a bridal company. And so she went back to work after about 3 months, and I was trying to rebuild everything, the business and teaching and things like that. And this all went on till December of 2011. And I got sick of my family telling me to come back to Australia. So I came back for a 2-week vacation over Christmas. And I arrived in Australia on the 21st of December. And the plan was just to stay for 2 weeks. But I had a flu when I arrived, when I got off the plane. So I decided to get a checkup. And they did a blood test. And when the results came back, the doctor was a little bit puzzled and didn't know what to make of it, because I looked very fit and healthy. I was lean. I mean, the day I left Japan, I went to the gym. And so he felt around my stomach a bit and he said, look, I think you should stay here and get this sorted out. And by this stage, I was feeling a bit puzzled myself. So I called my wife and I told her, look, I'm not sure I'll be able to go back to Japan on the scheduled date because I might be a little bit sicker than I thought. But she managed to get 3 weeks off work and come out and see me to find out what was going on. And the day she arrived, I got a call from hospital in the city. See, I was staying at my parents' place. It was about 4 hours drive in the countryside from the city. And they asked me to go into the hospital that night. It ended up being the next morning, but we went into the hospital and my head was spinning, actually. I got there and about 10 minutes later, they were rushing me into a ward. And I was in a bed and I had a team of doctors and nurses standing around me telling me, you know, it could be this, it could be that. We don't know. We've got this large mass inside there. We have to get tests done. It was crazy. It wasn't any questions asking me what I wanted to do or anything. It was just, okay, we have to do this. It's kind of like buying a used car. They want you to sign on the dotted line as soon as you walk in that door. Yeah. So it ended up being about a week's worth of test. And yeah, some of them quite painful actually. But the diagnosis comes back very high stage 4 blood cancer, follicular lymphoma.
You said follicular lymphoma?
Yeah. So that was a bit of a shock. I really didn't feel that bad. I was tired. And I was getting abdominal pain, but it wouldn't last. But the diagnosis was that it's stage 4, a very high stage 4 follicular lymphoma, which meant that all the lymph nodes in my body were now malignant tumors. So that was reeled right through my body. And midway down my aorta, I had a large tumor. It was about the size of a football. And because of the size of it, it had crushed all the organs around it, in particular my kidneys. It had killed my left kidney and my right kidney was down to 12%.
Wow.
Yeah. So if they gave me roughly 2 to 3 months to survive without treatment, and that would be on the outside if my kidney survived that long. And being down to 12%, they didn't really think that it would even be that long, because it would either be my kidneys or the cancer that would kill me. Before I could even have treatment, I had to get operations done on my kidneys, put stents in to try and get them flowing. They couldn't save the left one, but the right one came pretty good. Now the kidney's doing pretty well, even on carnival. From there, I had to do, they started me on what was called R-CHOP. R-CHOP is a particularly heavy dose chemotherapy. Is very violent, and that was probably the most painful one actually, except for the transplant later on. That was, it left your mouth like full of ulcers, bad reflux. My stomach was full of ulcers.
Excessive vomiting?
No, that's from the actual chemotherapy.
From the therapy itself, okay. But I know vomiting can cause that too, and people do get that from chemo sometimes.
Yeah. From the stomach acid, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, it was actually from the chemo. And all you can taste is chemotherapy. So basically the first 2 weeks after you pretty much can't eat anything. It was like pretty much like fasting because you just couldn't eat anything anyway. You couldn't keep
which is probably down. Good. It's probably a good thing. It's unintentional, but it's helpful, right?
Yeah, it was. It did turn out to be a little bit helpful because in the end, like about halfway through, all the medications they gave me to deal with it, including the steroids, I actually started limiting it, cutting it out, and stopped taking a lot of the medications because I just couldn't keep them down anyway.
Yeah.
But this one, like, it had a lot of bone pain associated with it too, as well. Like, it felt like even just lying in bed, it felt like it was the weight of your body was crushing your bones. I couldn't move because it was just really painful. So it was about there was 3 weeks between treatments and about 5 days where I actually felt human enough that I could eat.
And when you were going through these treatments and they got more and more painful and you were getting sicker and sicker, basically, and did your mind ever go to the point where we questioned, should I keep going? Or
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
The first one wasn't so bad. They split it up over 2 weeks for the treatment. After the first bag went through, actually, my wife, she only had 3 weeks off work, so she had to go back to Japan. And that was tough. That was the toughest part, actually, for me, because when she went back, she decided that she was going to move here to take care of me. Of course, I did give her options. I told her if she wanted to stay there, I would understand, because there's no point. I didn't see the point in her losing everything in her life just to look after me, sort of thing. I thought that would be selfish.
Yeah,
but I didn't even have to ask. She just told me to stop being stupid and said, yeah, it was not a problem. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, she was amazing. But we thought that might be the last time we'd see each other at the airport, actually, because they didn't think, oh, it's going to survive long enough for her to get back.
That's tough. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really tough, actually. And then going through the treatment, the first one wasn't too bad. The second one, that's when all the pain started. That's when you start all the violent vomiting. And
you're talking about the second round of chemo, the second type of chemo? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then by the third one, I'm thinking, Jesus, I don't know if this is worth it. In between, I'm having more operations on my kidneys. I had nowhere to live because this was all happening in Australia. We lost everything. So I lost my home, my business, career, everything. All I had with me was one backpack full of clothes. And I was staying in friends and family's spare rooms and lounge chairs while I was being treated.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah. You start to wonder why, if I should even bother keep fighting this.
Especially when they tell you your diagnosis is, I know this cancer, I've seen your other interviews. I know they're saying the best you're going to get is you'll be in remission or not active for a couple of years and it'll come back stronger. And then each time you do another round, you'll have a shorter period between the reactivation of the cancer, right? So it's going to get worse. Right. And if you had that much trouble going through the first time you had it, by the time the second time comes around, wow. Yeah, I can't imagine what it was like to make that decision to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a point. That's the thing that the original diagnosis, when they tell you it's follicular lymphoma, they tell you that the best you can hope for is a remission period.
Right.
But the more you treat it, the faster it comes back, the shorter the remission periods will be and the more aggressive the cancer will be. And it's already very high stage four. So how can it get more aggressive? But that didn't really bother me the first time because I was thinking that there would be a remission period.
Right. You know? You're going to beat it. You're thinking, and I'm sure you're in your head, you're thinking, I'm going to beat this too. That's what I would be thinking.
That's right.
I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said before, when I told my wife, look, if you want to stay in Japan, that's fine. I'd understand. One of the options I told her is that, look, if you stay there, maybe I can beat this in a year or less and I'll come back to Japan. So I was still thinking that this was just a temporary thing. I know that they told me this was a permanent thing. This is always going to be there, but I was still thinking this is a temporary thing. But by the third treatment came around and I'm thinking this is getting really brutal. And I don't know if I can go all the way out to 8, which is what the plan was.
Wow.
And 5 days, the 5 days before treatment, I start feeling good. And you start thinking, yeah, I can get through this. I can get through this. And that's what it was like the whole time. Until the 5th one, I was thinking, I started to get what they call white coat syndrome. And just the thought of going back to the hospital would make me sick.
Yeah.
Because I knew what they were going to do to me. So that was pretty tough. Obviously, I got through it. They did do the 8 treatments. And of course, we have all these different scans along the way and tests. And all it did was it reduced it from a stage 4 down to stage 2. But my blood was clear, which was good. And my tumor had shrunk about 30%. So it was still quite big, but at least it had shrunk. And then I started radiation, and we had 18 rounds of radiation just to target the tumor itself and try and shrink it down. And then they put me on a 2-year course of what they call a rituximab sort of treatment, which is another form of chemotherapy, but okay, every 2 months. So every 2 months I'd have a treatment done, and that wasn't too bad. It didn't have the pain associated like the R-CHOP did. I wasn't sick, but there was a bit of vomiting, but not too much. So after about 3 or 4 days, I felt fine. So that went on for about another year. And then I started going back to the gym. I was thinking, okay, I'm on top of this now. I'm starting to feel positive again.
Yeah.
And I was feeling pretty good, actually. I was feeling better than I had in a while, quite a while. So I was thinking, this is good. I'm going to be fine. I can go back to Japan soon. And then January 2014 comes around, and 2 years to the day, they tell me I'm very high stage 4 again.
Wow.
Even while I'm still going through treatment. And this treatment was supposed to give me a longer remission period. So, yeah, that was almost breaking point for me.
I can imagine.
Yeah, that was really demoralizing after going through all that and then telling me I'm back to square one. So I said to him, look, okay, I don't know if I can do this again. How long would you give me? How long do you think I could survive without it? And again, it was down to 3 or 4 months. At the time, I really just didn't think of any other options. I didn't think I had any other options. So right. They put me through a clinical trial for a drug called bendamustine. It's not actually a new drug, but it just hadn't been used in Australia. So they were doing a clinical trial, which gave me a few options. At the time, I was having a lot of other problems because of side effects from the first lot of chemotherapy. So before the clinical trial started, they rushed me through into have a couple of operations to help with those side effects. So that was one good thing. They told me this bendamustine was a lot more mild than the R-CHOP, so it wouldn't be as much vomiting. It wouldn't be that bone pain and things like that. So I thought, okay, it sounds pretty easy. Compared to R-CHOP, it'd have to be a cakewalk. And it was, for the most part, it was a lot easier. It wasn't as painful. But from the first treatment, it sent my fevers skyrocketing. They couldn't control them. I actually drove home because I didn't have anyone to drive me. I had to drive home myself after treatment. When I got home, my fever just started skyrocketing. My wife called an ambulance because I was just going to go to bed and try and sleep it off. But if I'd done that, I wouldn't have made it through the night.
Wow.
So that put me back in the hospital for a few nights. And then next few treatments were exactly the same. They ended up keeping me in because of my fevers. But treatment 2 and 3, they filled up both my arms with blood clots as well. So,
wow.
Yeah, really scary. Long. Yeah, that was it was really scary at the time. Really long, thick blood clots that went right down from my shoulder to my wrist.
Hmm.
And my arms looked like a 3D roadmap. So then they decided to put a port into my chest. It's like it sits under your skin and they just plug it in and feed it straight into your heart, which was scary at the time because they just filled up both my arms. So I'm thinking, what's this going to do to my heart?
Yeah. But they had no choice. They couldn't feed you through your arms anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So, there was just no option.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to try and they weren't going to stop the treatment. So we did that. And again, after that, it wasn't so bad. The treatment just continued through that. It was still fairly mild compared to the R-CHOP. It was a lot of fasting, like forced fasting. For the first week, at least, I couldn't eat because I couldn't keep anything down. But throughout the trial, of course, we were having update scans and tests and everything like this, and it did nothing towards the cancer.
Wow. So it was ineffective.
It was completely ineffective.
Other than making you feel terrible and clotting.
Yeah, blood. Yeah. It did a good job of killing me, but not the cancer. A lot of the treatments, it's not just the chemotherapy. A lot of the medications they put you on afterwards, like going right through all this whole period, this 2 years, were all steroids as well.
Yeah.
So they're pretty much driving my blood sugars up throughout this whole time, which is would be just feeding the cancer.
Yeah, I was just told, and I didn't know this before, and it may be wrong. I was told from someone who's not a doctor, but that PET scans, what they actually do is they feed you a radioactive marker on sugar and they feed it into your system. And wherever there's tumors, the sugar goes and starts feeding them. And that's how they can see the tumors because the sugar activity. So it tells you right there that these tumors thrive on sugar, right?
Yeah.
And I didn't know that. I think that's pretty amazing.
Oh, it is. If you see it at a cellular level, you can see it actually absorbing the sugars. It eats it up. It just thrives on it. And this was a big problem. Like through that 2 year period, I was on steroid treatment all the way through. And I think that's what shortened my remission as well.
Oh, you mean in between 2012, 2014?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause I was still on treatment every 2 months. And so they gave me steroids to help recover. And of course, right through the treatment, the trials, and later on as well. Then we got midway through this treatment, and they found that it wasn't doing anything, but they decided to keep going. And we got to the end, so we went, like the most treatments you're allowed to do on these heavy dose treatments is 8. After that, you pretty much just kill the patient. So that's what they took me out to, 8 on both treatments. They took me out to 8 treatments.
Wow.
And it did nothing. Again, in fact, it was just the cancer was thriving.
So you're still at stage 4 and you're just weaker now.
Yeah, I'm just weaker. I just lost composition, really. I just lost muscle and gained a lot of fat. I was very bloated. That photo of on my page, you can see how bloated I was.
Yeah.
It wasn't from eating. I hadn't been eating that whole year. I hadn't eaten very much. It's just from the steroids.
That's inflammation and water retention. And your whole body's inflamed.
Yeah, exactly. So they decided to do a heavy dose stem cell transplant. So this needed another line into my heart. This was a CV line, and it has 2 rubber tubes plugged straight into your heart, and it just hangs out of your chest, and it has 2 little adapters so that they can run 3 different chemotherapy treatments through over a 24-hour period, 24 hours at a time for 7 days. The first 7 days of the transplant, I'm getting chemotherapy just pumped through my body. So it completely destroys everything. And day 3, I had an infection in the CV line. And from there, I just had all sorts of trouble, my heart trouble and breathing, and they couldn't keep me stable. I would stop breathing and they had trouble keeping me going for quite a while throughout the rest of the treatment. And it was pretty much just cooked me from inside. And
right.
it was a really tough time. I really wasn't there a whole lot after that. My wife was coming in every day. I ended up being in there 5 weeks, and my wife came in every single day with something that she would cook something in the morning, hoping that I could eat something. Then she'd catch a bus in and sit there all day long and then until night, and then go home and go shopping for me to do it all over again for that 5 week. It was just amazing. It really kept me going, because it when I was awake, when I could see her, seeing her there, really lightened my heart. It really made me feel a lot better about being there. I'd wake up, I'd have all these breathing machines on me, all these heart rate monitors and all sorts of machines on me, and doctors and nurses and standing around me. Through the infection, I was quarantined. It was really rough. That was just the beginning of it. After the treatment finished, because I had been cooked so much inside, I had a lot of ulcers in my stomach. My brain was cooked, all my organs. I was passing and bringing up like thick layers of skin because everything had just been burnt from the inside. And I looked like a red lobster actually for weeks after that. My skin on the outside was red. Yeah, long story short, I got home about 5 weeks later.
So did it put you into remission again, though? Were they able to get you back down from stage four?
Yeah, it brought me back down to stage two again.
Okay. And you get back home 5 weeks later?
Yeah, 5 weeks later. And it had dried. It had cooked me so much that all my bones, my muscles and connective tissue were so dry and brittle. I couldn't move. To get home, I needed a wheelchair. And then I pretty much just swapped their bed for my bed. And that's where I stayed for the next 2.5 years.
Wow.
And it took me that long before I could actually walk at a semi-regular pace that I could keep up with my wife.
So we're talking 2017 is when you start walking again.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And we were just in a tiny little studio that was pretty close to the hospital, because I had to keep going back to the hospital every week. And it was literally like 2 steps to my bathroom from my bed. And I couldn't even do that without help. And for me, that was, I'm very active. I've always been very active. That was a real struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know after being, I was an athlete all my life, and then, you know, being athletic at least, and then being a soldier and military and being able to physically perform a lot. Once my body started deteriorating, I couldn't do that. It was a big mental blow for me where I couldn't even run. 2017, I had a, what they call a profile. I couldn't run anymore. And so since 2017, I haven't run more than like a sprint, a short sprint since 2017. But this month I've healed up enough where I've actually ran 2 miles this week, which is amazing. I love running, and I'm back. I feel like I'm coming back. So I know what that mental thing is like. Nowhere near where you were at, but once you've been an athlete or you've been able to perform and you can't anymore, it's a big deal. It is.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, that's remarkable. Yeah, the feeling when you come back to the excitement when you get back into it too. That's such a great positive jump too.
Yeah, the endorphins.
Yeah, it feels amazing.
It does.
But through all that period, I couldn't move because of the muscles and everything. I just didn't know how, my muscles just didn't know how to contract or relax again. I had trouble breathing. So that eventually I found a deep breathing exercises that it would help me get at least that going.
Yeah.
And that made me feel a lot better too, starting to move again, which helped me get on with trying to walk and trying to move again later on.
At what point in your recovery did you start craving meat? I remember you talking in one of your interviews. I saw that your body instinctively started craving meat.
Yeah, that was immediate. That was immediate. Okay. After the transplant, when I could start eating again, for the first time in my life, actually, I was really craving meat. I didn't understand why at the time. I knew I'm a strength coach, so I knew I needed proteins and to rebuild and to try and get my muscles moving again. But I really didn't think about it. I really didn't understand why at the time. But I would just, the only meals I really wanted, like my wife would cook me some meat and I'd get hungry again. Even in the middle of the night, I'd get up and I'd cook a kilo of steak. And she started calling me the midnight chef because it was the only time I'd cook. That was quite good. But actually, that funny story, through the transplant, because a number of times I stopped breathing, the nurses would come in and wake me up if I was sleeping because they wanted to check that I was still breathing.
Uh-huh.
And for about 3 years after that, my wife would do the same thing. If I was sleeping for too long, like a couple of hours sleeping, she'd wake me up just to make sure that I'm still breathing. Funny at the time, but it was also annoying because I was trying to sleep. But anyway,
Now, how long, I want to skip ahead, how long have you been cancer-free now?
They won't say that I'm cancer-free yet.
But you're in remission. Because how long have you been in remission?
I'm in remission. So I've been in remission now 9 years.
Wow. So you've smashed their record books and blown away anything they said. And now what about that tumor?
Now the tumor is gone.
Gone. They didn't surgically remove it?
No, they can't. They can't do surgery on this tumor. So they had to shrink it down. But it didn't actually go away until much later, after the transplant, about... That took a couple of years.
Yeah.
Throughout that period, I noticed that I was craving meat. So what I started doing was eating more and more meat. And I just figured I was going back to a more caveman sort of diet.
A primal.
More primal. I didn't know about the carnivore diet or anything like that at the time. But I did still, my wife's Japanese, so we did still eat a fair bit of rice, fruit and vegetables. The education is you got to have your fruit and vegetables. You need fiber. You need this. You need that. Yeah. And all the experts are telling me you need high fiber and all sorts of stuff as well. Some of the dietary advice you get from the hospital is just insane.
Yeah.
They literally feed you junk food while you're being treated.
You know? It's all thanks to the dietary guidelines set out by the Warren Commission, I think, in America, from Ansel Keys' research. It was all bogus, and his six-country study and all that bogus stuff he did.
Yeah,
pretty crazy. Yeah,
exactly.
And now we're all sick because of it.
Mm. Yeah, it's insane.
Yeah, it really is.
From there, my main meal was always meat, but I still had the side dishes, just the fruit, vegetables, and rice and that sort of thing. But we never eat out is one key thing as well. We don't eat any processed foods, except we did still have snacks, cookies and cakes and things like that.
Sure. But
even that, most of that my wife would make. And so at the time,
whole foods and low sugar, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the time, I really didn't care because the experts would keep telling me that the most you can get is a short remission period and it's coming back. And I was pretty much just living blood test to blood test. And at first, that was weekly, you know. So when you get a blood test done, you think it's always in the back of your mind, is it going to be back again? Is it coming back? So that part is the hardest part to get around.
Yeah.
And eventually it went from a weekly visit and a weekly test to 6 months. And I'm still at 6 months now.
Yeah.
And for a number of years, I was still just living 6 months at a time. And I wouldn't even, like the lease on our little apartment, I wouldn't even sign a lease longer than 6 months.
You know? Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah. Because it just, yeah. it was just wasn't practical to think long term. So the problem with that though is that when you're not thinking long term, you've got no goals, you've got no direction right. either. You know, so there's no point planning like a life ahead of a blood test. That's what it was for us. But I just kept eating more and more meat and feeling more and more healthier and better.
Yeah.
It took me 5 years though before I could actually go back to the gym. My education has always been lean meats. So
right.
I've always avoided fats. And I think that's what happened. I think that's one of the reasons why I got sick in the first place is because of what they call rabbit starvation.
Yep.
Not enough fat in the diet, too high protein.
That protein breaks down to sugars. It's akin to eating sugar. I know that they taught us about that in the Army Survival School. So yeah.
Yeah.
Rabbit starvation is a real thing. It's protein poisoning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've been eating clean for this 9 years, but I still had trouble with colds and flus, and they would last me months. A cold would last me literally up to 3 months.
Yeah.
And it would always develop into a flu. And sometimes it could make me sick enough to actually put me back in hospital.
Wow. Your immune system was probably wrecked out too from.
Yeah.
I know I've had people in my family had gone through chemo and their immune system usually gets wiped out or pretty weakened.
Yeah. Yeah, it's completely wiped out. One of the biggest setbacks actually was about 6 months after the transplant, my immune system did start recovering, but then they gave me all these vaccine injections to supposedly help with my immune system, but that just crashed my immune system again.
Wow.
That was one of my really big setbacks. And it took me about 5 years to recover from that.
Wow.
And from there, so I was always trying to find a way to improve my immune system. So I was always adding things to my diet, turmeric and cinnamon and nutmeg and all these other herbs and spices and fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. Because when you go through all this sort of, you'd want to try anything that will help. But again, I was still avoiding fats, and that was a problem. So I kept it in remission for quite a long time, just doing what I was doing. But my numbers were still quite low. My blood markers were really low still, even though I was still going back to the gym. And I would still get colds and flus. It would put me out of the gym again for a few months at a time. But when I found carnivore, that's when everything changed.
And you know, when was that? How did that happen? How did you find carnivore?
My wife found it, actually.
Okay.
She found it. A young bodybuilder, he said that he only eats meat. And then I found all these other people. Yeah, they said they only eat meat. And my first reaction, honestly, my first reaction was bullshit.
Yeah, that's okay. Crazy.
Yeah, I said, that's bullshit because, I mean, it's a gimmick because athletes have been cutting carbs for decades long trying to get lean. Whenever they have a competition coming up, they'll cut carbs because to get lean and faster. So it was nothing new. And I was thinking, they're ridiculous. But then I found Dr. Baker, and I related to him because he's a lifter and he's a smart guy. So I started looking at some of the research, and I was looking at what they were doing with diabetes and things like that. They hadn't actually done anything with cancer, but then I found Professor Seyfried and others as well. And I'm thinking, okay, they haven't actually done anything specifically with this, but it's worth a try. Because I was pretty much stagnating where I was. I needed to change something because it just wasn't going anywhere. So I had to change. I had to make a change. So I figured, let's give it a try.
And when was this? How long ago?
I'm in now, day 165-ish now.
Okay. I'm on day like 206 now. So you're 165. Okay. So you're not far behind me.
Yeah. I figured, all right, I'm either going to prove this wrong or prove it right.
Yeah, that's what I did.
Yeah.
I didn't believe it either. I was like, it's BS, man. It's a gimmick. It's a scam.
Yeah, for sure. I was trying to find something. What are they trying to sell here? And
because no one was selling anything other than t-shirts. There was no selling going on, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I was, Adam, I'm not buying a damn t-shirt.
I'm not buying a shirt. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
But then I figured, okay, if I'm going to do this, let's do it 100%. So I stopped taking supplements. I figured, okay, I cut everything straight down to just meat and eggs and butter. And the hardest part was getting my head around the eating more fats, because I've been so
hard.
I've been so regimental in eliminating fats, trying to stay a low fat diet my whole life. So that took me some time. And even now I'm still increasing my fat intake. But in the first 3 months, I had to see my oncologist again, and I had a blood test done, and all my blood markers jumped on average across the board between 8 and 10 points.
Wow. You know, that's huge.
That's for every blood test around about a week before my blood test. It was always a very stressful time for me, because it was always, will it be back? Because the first 2 times I was diagnosed, I didn't feel sick.
Yeah.
So I just don't know when it's going to be back. But after that, I started getting excited. And I'm thinking, okay.
I can imagine.
This is going well. Over the years, I've been doing research on all different ways to try and improve this, working on my lymphatic system and my immune system. Because lymphoma, it's called lymphoma because it starts in your lymphatic system.
Right.
So this is what I need to improve. And of course, your immune system is part of your lymphatic system. So then I started getting really excited. And for the last 4 years, I haven't had a local GP doctor, because basically they're just drug pushers. And here they are just ridiculous, beyond belief. But I found recently a guy who's coming out from Japan and is very good, actually. So I started going and seeing him. And now I'm having blood tests every 3 months, because I am so excited to watch these blood markers go up.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, I had another blood test done. And 3 months from the first one on Carnival, and my blood markers have not just jumped, they've actually just crept inside, all of them, right across the board, just inside a normal healthy range.
It kind of points, I think Dr. Baker was actually talking about this the other day, or maybe even today, that cancer is a metabolic disease, or some doctors are saying that it's caused by metabolic syndrome or metabolic issues. So if you have a metabolic disease, you're feeding cancer. And if you get rid of that, you can starve cancer. And I think that's what's happening, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, it is definitely a metabolic disease, not a genetic thing, which is what everyone keeps treating you for or telling you it is. When I was first diagnosed, they said this particular cancer is very rare in younger people. I was only 38 when I was diagnosed, or I was actually 37, almost 38. And they keep telling you how rare it is, because you're so young and all this sort of stuff. Of course, it doesn't feel rare when you get diagnosed.
Yeah.
But they said no one knows how it happens. It's just genetics. That's the answer you get. I mean,
genetics will make you more susceptible or less susceptible of getting it, but it won't give you cancer, right? Cancer is something that happens based on, you have proclivity and then you introduce something to it that can cause that. Right? So you get damaged mitochondria. Yeah.
Anyone that has damaged mitochondria is going to have something manifest, and your genetics might determine what it manifests.
How bad, how fast, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that's about it. But either way, the result, it's all these things are all down the line of where it starts is with your mitochondria. It's so that's why it's really important to me to try and repair all that. especially after the damage that the chemotherapy has done.
Oh, sure. It wrecked you.
Yeah, it's far worse than the disease itself.
So I don't have to ask you why you started the carnivore diet, because I know you stumbled backwards into it and then it started working. So that's why you did that. But I would like to start focusing on your YouTube channel because we're running low on time. We've got a great story here. You're in full remission right now. Been for what, 9 years? That's great. And you're 165 days into carnivore, feeling better than you probably have. Your workouts are probably amazing. What I want to know now is, why did you start a YouTube channel? What prompted that and why?
Okay. The reason I started that is because I think people need to know that there are options, for one, not only for treatments of cancer and but other diseases as well, mitochondrial health. But there's just so many people suffering from cancer right now. In America, for example, 1,700 people a day are dying from cancer. But they will tell you that they are dying from cancer. But the thing is, most people are dying from the treatments. And they don't separate that number from how many died from the treatments and how many died from the actual disease.
Yeah.
If this is something I can help prevent, that's what my goal is, to help prevent that sort of thing. I also want people to understand that just because you have a tough time, you're having a tough time now. Tough times are not permanent. I've been through multiple large earthquakes, a tsunami. I've lost everything. I lost my home, my career. I had to move internationally. I mean, these are tough times. Treatments, these chemotherapy treatments that pretty much destroy your body inside out, your organs, your brain. My brain was mush for years. And still a bit mushy, but it's
getting better. Yeah.
So that's another thing too. On the carnivore diet, you are increasing ketones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a lot of the biggest things that carnivores say are beneficial of the carnivore diet is that brain fog lifts.
Yeah.
And this is because we're getting more ketones to our brain. We can think better. Everything is starting to fall into place because we're getting the proper nutrients. And if I can come back from my deathbed to where I am now, I'm sure that anyone can. No matter how tough you think life is right now, if you just hold on, if you keep pushing forward, you get back up and keep walking, you will get there.
Yeah, that's what I like. It's resilience, right? And it's getting knocked down and getting back up. That's resilience. Exactly. And you can't read about it. You got to take the reps. Now, you got knocked down really hard. Not everyone gets knocked down that hard, but everyone gets knocked down. And you just got to learn how to get up.
Yeah. You're going to have setbacks. Everyone does.
So even you're on carnivore, you still get them. It's not going to change.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't matter what diet you are on. You are always going to have setbacks. So don't expect your whole life to be all rainbows and unicorns just because you go carnivore, but you're gonna have setbacks. But the thing is, you just have to take the hits and keep going.
I think it's easier to bounce back up because you are physically in better shape and mentally in better shape and emotionally in better shape. So I think once you've got carnivore established, it is a little easier to be more resilient.
I think you don't have as much anxiety for a start. You don't have as much self-doubt either because you are thinking better.
Right. Confidence is there. Yeah. Confidence. That's huge. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Before carnivore diet, honestly, I don't think I would ever even think about starting a YouTube channel.
Me neither. I never did. I had a YouTube channel because I was a drone pilot and I shared videos on it and shared home movies with my family. So my channel's been around for years and years, but I never published anything on it until August 7th of this year. And that's purely driven by me and the confidence I have and wanting to get the message out to other people, because I knew in my immediate circle, I had shared it and people started benefiting and then they started sharing it. And I saw like a ripple effect from people I didn't even know who were actually doing it because I shared it with someone, they shared it with someone else. And I thought, wow, this is huge. What if I went and shared it on a YouTube channel? That's what I thought. Maybe I could reach a few people. And apparently it struck a nerve with people because people started joining really rapidly. And it's great. I love having a community. It's like when I was a platoon leader in the Army, I love my platoon. I like these guys. These are my kind of people. And I really like to surround myself with people who are like-minded and goal-oriented and help people achieve their goals.
Yeah. You've got a great channel too. I love the way it's set up.
Oh, thanks, man.
You know, that's the thing. We all have setbacks. I've had some really major setbacks in early, like even after the transplant, different setbacks through different treatments that they've given me to try and improve things that did the opposite. But the thing is, what's done is done. All you can do is, okay, this is the new starting point. This is where I have to, this is where I am now. This, I have to get away from here somehow. It doesn't really matter. To me, it didn't matter how or what I did. I just have to get away from this place. So I have to keep moving. It didn't matter what direction I went in, because it would have to be better than where I was. And a lot of people are like that. They don't have a direction. They don't have a goal. But just do anything. Do something. That will lead. I look at it sometimes as driving at night when your headlights only let you see so far. And then when you get to that point, you can see a little bit further. If you don't have an idea in mind, a goal in mind, just do something and you will find a direction from the next point. You will find, okay, the next point will be revealed to you. Okay, I can do this, so maybe I can try this as well.
That's what I love about this way of eating, though, for me. And you have to have a big why. Your big why obviously was huge. It was your health. And it was to change something because you were stagnant. For me, it was like I was sliding down towards a painful death, probably, you know, a long and protracted sickness of being metabolically obese and sick and all these diseases coming on. And so that was my why, was to reverse that. And that's when I thought I'd test it to see if it did. But what's great about this diet or this way of eating is you don't have to wait for long. Like you, your first 90 days, you saw results. Me, my first 30 to 60 days, I saw results. I really started seeing things immediately. And I think if you really sell out and do it, you don't have to guess whether it's working. It just starts working.
I love
that. And that's pretty amazing. So it's the one thing I've ever done that's been like that. I've never done anything like that that's actually been that much of a return that quickly, I don't think.
No, I'm the same. It's a very immediate reaction. It's a very reactive diet. Your body is so much more sensitive. And I think that's a great thing too about mental health as well. Because you are so much more sensitive, you pick up more things. You just see things a lot clearer. Body-wise as well, you're so reactive. If you have too much fats, for example, or you have not enough sort of thing, you'll know. Yeah. Yeah. The body will tell you immediately, like that day, not years down the track, because I think like on the standard diet, you're just not so sensitive to what your body is telling you.
So back to your YouTube channel, what are your goals for your YouTube channel? Do you have any, have you set those out yet? Or do you know what would you consider a successful YouTube channel? What would be a success in this venture for you?
The biggest success for me would be to help as many people as I can, actually. I haven't really set out a big plan for that because I'm still trying to focus on my book at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about your book.
Okay. I'm editing the book now. I still have to put in more sort of results from the diet because I'm going to incorporate the carnivore
diet. It takes some time, right?
Yeah. I have to whittle it down a bit because the last 12 years it's hard to fit all that into a book small enough for people to read. I don't want to give my 1,000 pages, but yeah, it's called Not Done Yet because I'm not done. And you know, this is what I want people to see as well, is that it doesn't matter what the setback is. Doesn't matter how hard it is. You're not done until you say you are.
I don't know if you've ever stayed to the end of one of my videos, but at the end, I have drums playing and I have a thing that has a semicolon and it says, your story isn't finished.
Yeah.
And that's because people think there's a period there at their life right now and their story's done. But I can tell you, for me, I'm starting to plan things. I was not planning things 6 months ago. Now I'm planning like long-term stuff down the road. that wasn't happening because my mind and my physical. Like you probably don't wait 6 months to 6 months or 3 months or month to month. You can start looking forward like this book. That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's the thing. Exactly the same, actually. Yeah, like I've gone from planning like the most at 6 months at a time to now I'm thinking long term. I'm thinking, okay, and I'm thinking about returning to Japan or moving to a different country. I'd love to try living in America for some time. It would be really great.
Yeah, Austin's great.
Yeah, actually, I love Texas. You guys,
Texas are great is wonderful. Great beef.
Yeah, lots of I love barbecue.
Oh yeah, the barbecue here is amazing.
Yeah, so that's something I want to do. I actually now have this is one thing that's kept me going through this last 9 years is that I have things I want to do still.
Yes,
and the list is only growing now. That's whereas great. Before it was I was trying to limit it down because I didn't think I'd have the time or the chance.
So it was like your bucket list before, but now it's like an adventure list, right? It's not the bucket list. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's a life list.
There you go.
Yeah. So that's a big change for me. And, you know, the difference in the way I think and feel, even going from where I was before, which would be more of a ketogenic sort of diet that helped get me in remission, but to carnivore is a different world.
And Dr. Chafee talks about this and the difference between I've done keto too, and I fell off both times and I had good results, good, not awesome, good results both times. I did it when I was active duty, trying to get ready for schools or get ready for military physical tests. And they actually worked. But I think the difference, and Dr. Chafee brings this up, so every 1% you deviate from a completely pure carnivore diet, you lose 10% efficiency or effectiveness in the diet. So if you do a 95% carnivore, you're probably losing 50% of its effectiveness. And I agree with that. So when we're doing keto, we're probably only getting 5 or 10% of the effectiveness of the diet.
That's right. Yeah.
In my opinion, right. In my experience too.
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, even though I was in remission on a ketogenic sort of style diet, I still had immune problem issues and my blood markers were stagnating. They weren't growing.
Yeah. You weren't making gains. So, you were
It was just pretty much flatlining. And it wasn't until I went strict carnivore that all that changed. You know, and I was thinking better over the years. I was thinking better. I was feeling better. I had eliminated almost all of my medications. I'd gone from 40 plus different medications down to one.
Wow.
Ketogenic.
Yeah, no, and nothing bad with keto. Keto is a good diet. It's healthy.
Yeah, that's right. Clean. Yeah, it's like you're almost there.
Yeah.
But on carnivore, I'm on completely zero medications and zero supplements.
You know, and you're making gains every test. Yeah.
And I'm making gains. Yeah, exactly. So it's been a complete reversal, really.
That's amazing.
It's just incredible.
David, we're running out of time here, so I want you to tell people how they can get in touch with you or where they can follow you. I've got your YouTube page up here, but this is going to be a podcast too, so you might want to tell them where to get a hold of you on your social media.
Okay, so you can get me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Facebook, it's all the same name, DC Learning to Live. Facebook, we also have a page for people who have been affected by cancer, and we are looking at treatments and dietary supplementing and looking at it as a metabolic disease. It's linked to my page there. You can find it.
Is it a group? A Facebook group?
Yes, a group, a Facebook group. Yeah.
And then on YouTube, you're at DC Learning to Live, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, and it's just the letters DC with Learning to Live. Great. Yeah, you got some good videos on there, and you can catch him also with some other guys like Intentional Carnivore doing interviews and on some groups with Carnivore Backwoods. I know you're making the rounds. You've got a great story. You're going to make difference in people's lives. Like for my channel, I focus on veteran and first responder mental health, because I think that the standard American diet, the brain fog is causing people to commit suicide more than they were before this diet was introduced. Because I think it's just moved the tipping point. So if I could save one person with my channel, that's like my goals. And just like yours, if you could help people, like one person reverse their cancer, that'd be an amazing outcome for your channel.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. That's the thing too. A lot of the depression involved, especially first responders, and others, is low cholesterol diets.
Yes.
Has been proven, like studies from, I've found recently studies from the 90s, 2013, 2019, proving low cholesterol diets connected to a high rate of depression to the point of suicide.
And that's what they feed us in the military. A low-fat, low-cholesterol diet.
Yeah,
and that's right. High carbohydrate. It's terrible. Yeah,
it's crazy. And this is something I saw a lot in Japan, too. After my sister, actually, she took her own life when I was younger.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's been a long time. But in Japan, after the quake and the tsunami, so many people in the hundreds were taking their lives because of everything they had lost through that period. And a lot of them were also first responders. They saw a lot of tragic sort of things. And even when we went out to shelters and things like that, see all these people living in these shelters, the damage, it was horrific. After the aftermath, I actually have a photo book called The Aftermath of 3/11.
Yeah, I've worked just hurricanes in America where cities were just destroyed. And we've been in there and everyone loses everything.
Yeah.
And the aftermath is total devastation is total. It's just like you were saying, if you haven't experienced it, pictures and movies don't do it justice. You have to actually live it and smell it. And it's pretty awesome. But hey, listen, I got to get going, man. It's been great having you on, David. I'm going to drop you out. Stick around for a minute. And we'll talk for a minute. I'm going to drop you out and say goodbye on the channel. And we'll keep going from here in a few minutes. All right. Hold on.
Thanks, Grant.
All right, guys. That was a great interview. All I got to say is stay strong and overcome. Carnivore Soldier out.